It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. It's hard to imagine, but in the 1870s, the American West, as far as most Americans east of the Mississippi were concerned, might as well have been Siberia. It was so far away, and it would take weeks or months on dangerous stagecoach journeys to get there. But in 1869, the first transcontinental railroad made history by linking east and west, but relying heavily on federal grants, it left an opening for two brash new railroad men, the Civil War hero behind the Rio Grande and the corporate chieftain of the Santa Fe, to build the first transcontinental to make money by creating a railroad empire across the Southwest to the Pacific Ocean. The railroad companies were governments on wheels. They set the course, chose the route, and built up cities and towns along their tracks. Their choices brought life to such out-of-the-way places as San Diego, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Denver, and Los Angeles. The Santa Fe turned a sleepy backwater of 30,000, which was Los Angeles' population at the time, into a booming metropolis of 150,000 in 3 years, the most explosive growth of any city in the history of the United States. By then, the two men behind the Rio Grande on the Santa Fe had fought all across the West to lay claims to routes that would secure the most profitable territory and the richest silver mines. But they often led through narrow mountain passes or up treacherous canyons with room for only a single set of tracks. To win them, each side turned hundreds of their train workers into private armies, backed by local militia and paid mercenaries like Dodge City's Bat Masterson. The war left one of the two lines reeling in a death spiral, and sent the other onto greatness unequaled by any other railroad in the world. I'm joined today by John Sedgwick, author of the new book From the River to the Sea, The Untold Story of the Railroad War That Made the West. And it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of railroads. The way they developed the West is as important, if not more important, than the way that the automobile developed suburban America in the 20th century. Also, there's a lot of parallels between big tech, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, and how in many industries, these tech companies form a duopoly or even a monopoly and have incredible power. What effect an industry that has incredible power, like the railroad companies in the 19th century, can have on the United States, and how it can all come crashing down in an instant. So it's a very important history, and there's a lot of parallels to today. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with John Sedgwick. John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's so nice to be here with you again, Scott.
Yeah, the last time was a couple of years ago. We talked about your book, Blood Moon, looking at relations with American Indians and others in the United States. Now we're going to be looking at another topic of the 19th century, which has to do with railroads. And I'm a historian of the 19th century, so you don't have to sell me on their importance. But I think for a lot of people, they really don't get how important railroads were in this period of American history. Because if you think of railroads now, you imagine the subculture of grown men who are into model trains and go to into conventions, you know, that guy who's into model trains, or Amtrak, which is great, but not exactly a vision of speed or convenience in America. But during the 1870s, railroads fundamentally changed how Americans understood their own nation. So to start things off, can you describe to me How would an average American's perception of America change from before railroad networks were built out to after they were built out?
Well, that's a really great question. The transformation was profound. And honestly, it's not too much to say that the railroads did for America in the 19th century what the internet has done for America in the 21st century. And what do I mean by this? Well, it changed, the railroads changed our understanding of physical space. That's a lot to say, but the fact is that it used to be in America as elsewhere, the distance was defined by how far you could go on foot initially, and then it was how far a horse or a wagon could take you. And then it was how far a train could take you. And as you think about that, the difference obviously is fantastic. And so what the term for this in the 19th century was the annihilation of space, that people no longer thought in terms of sort of foot length distance. Something was no longer 10 miles, 100 miles, 1,000 miles away, whatever. It was how many days it took you to get there. It was a matter of time. It wasn't a matter of distance. People didn't really have a sense of the distance. But so something was a day away, 2 days away, 3 days away. And then it became a matter of cost. It was how much did it cost to get you there? It was like $50 away, $100 away. As you can imagine, that's a substantial change in your understanding of the world. And then there was another part of it, which is that America, back when it was defined, in the 18th century and then into the 19th century, that America was really, it was just the East. It was east of the Mississippi. And east of the Mississippi was a place where you got around by, if you were to travel any distance, you would go by water. You would go along rivers, you would go along canals, you would go along the coastline by sea. Mostly went north-south because the coastline and the major rivers went north-south. Well, when the railroads came, you didn't have to go north-south anymore. You could go east-west. And in doing so, it shifted the orientation of the United States from being a north-south country to being an east-west country. And that transformation that created the America that we know today.
Absolutely. I mean, to underline that even more, what you just said there, it changed the physics of how people understood travel, railroads, where from the beginning of civilization, 5,000 years ago, until maybe the 1830s or so, there was a hard physics of how far you could go in a day that really didn't change much from when you were in the Roman Empire up into colonial America. In fact, Rome might have been faster because of the road network. But being able to go faster than this is like our government coming up with faster than light travel, a warp drive, essentially, something that lets you transcend the laws of physics as they've been understood by travel for a very long time. So tell me about one other meta issue before we get into the particular characters in your book. With this amount of power, railroad companies must have been transcendently powerful, especially before you have things like antitrust laws. So tell me about the power of railroad companies once they start laying down these tracks and controlling these networks.
Well, that's a really important subject. Railroad companies, once they were nationalized, going coast to coast, became so powerful that they negotiated with the federal government as equals. They were themselves virtually a sovereign nation. And that it's amazing to think, but the stock market was largely the railroad market. Most of the stocks that were traded were railroad stocks. The railroads, because of their size and impact, had it's almost frighteningly big impact on the national economy. When the railroad stocks dipped, the whole United States went into recession. When they rose, they then went into what was later called irrational exuberance. There was this tumultuousness that was built into the national economy because of the size of the railroads. And not that different, really, from what's happening with Google and Amazon today, but more because there really weren't other stocks. They were virtually the only stocks that were bought and sold. So these national manias became enormously consequential for the national economy, and led in 1877, one of these terrible panics, as they were called, led to a railroad strike of 1877 that consumed the nation. It was the biggest walkout the nation had ever seen. The federal government had to be called in order to force the workers back to work. The city of Pittsburgh went up in flames because of the worker dispute. The workers were outraged when the federal government started shooting at them, and they set the city on fire. And that was the consequence of the railroads.
Can you tell me about these particular companies, the Santa Fe and the Rio Grande? Because I know about some of the tycoons of this period, specifically John Rockefeller, rising from pretty humble origins, but then going on to become the world's first billionaire. Who were the men who founded these companies, and how did they build them up?
Well, these companies are distinctive for one particular reason, and that is that they built their railroads on private capital. They relied not at all on federal grants. The first transcontinental, as you will remember, from 1869, the famous one, the one that gets all the attention, which was the combination of the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific that famously joined at Promontory Point on May 10th, 1869. And it created a national hullabaloo because for the first time, you could get on a train from New York and then go through to Chicago and then on from there on to San Francisco. And that was all built with federal money. Well, the downside of that was that it became largely a political act. It was something sort of like the moonshot of the 19th century. It was like the Apollo program, where we got to the moon, but we didn't know what to do with it because there was no commercial basis for doing so. And same thing with the first transcontinental. They got to San Francisco, but who wanted to go there that fast? It cost life savings practically to get a ticket. And that they didn't build up any traffic along the way because it was just one line through the wilderness that terminated in San Francisco. And there weren't a lot of cross lines to feed that trunk line as it went along. So there really wasn't that much need for it. Well, into that come my two guys, General William J. Palmer of the Rio Grande and William Barstow Strong of the Santa Fe. Who were they and what were those railroad lines? Well, the Rio Grande was started in Denver with the idea of going south, possibly as far south as the Bay of California on the western coast of Mexico. And Palmer's idea was that there were these other lines that were competing for that to be the second transcontinental after that famous first one I just mentioned. But all of them were headed due west, and he was going to go west by going south through Mexico to the Bay of California, as I said, where he would hit the Pacific there, and then continue on to California by ship, or the shippers could then get to Australia and the Far East by shipping their goods from Mexico. And so that was his idea. But the Santa Fe, by contrast, was going to do the sort of expected thing. It was going to go west. By going west, it was going to go from Kansas through Colorado, across the Rockies, and then to California. And so these two lines intersected at a little town called Pueblo, which, as I say, the Rio Grande going south, Santa Fe going west, and they both hit the same kind of Pueblo. And then what was amazing to me was that their basic understandings and their guesses about the future and their intentions radically shifted. That each man decided that he was going to do it like the other. And that even though this General Palmer was a very sort of self-directed, independent, heroic guy who sort of took his own counsel and didn't listen to anybody else, that once Strong came on the picture, he thought, maybe there's another way of doing this. And so the question was, where would they go? Now, where would they actually, literally, right down to the square inch, where would they place their roots? And that was always the really difficult decision for these railroad men in the West. Because you have to remember that in the 1870s, the West was wide open. Yes, there was that first transcontinental, but there were no other railroads. And so they could put their lines down anywhere. Well, where do you put them? Do you go for a silver mine or a gold mine and then risk that mine is going to be played out in short order, so you're going to be sending a line to the No Place Valuable? Do you aim for some that wonderful cropland that's going to deliver the crops and therefore offer a reason to go there for years and years, but then you run the risk that maybe locusts will come and that the crops will not rise? Do you go for that little settlement in Utah that's maybe where the Mormons were, but then you run the risk that maybe that settlement will die out because of whatever reason? There were no major places to be sure to go because there were no major places. And the railroads created those places. They had to decide for themselves where they should go. And it was enormously risky. Well, one of the ways that they could tell where a good place to go was, if your rival wanted it, it must be good. And this was the problem that came up over and over for Palmer and Strong, was that they couldn't decide on their own where to go. So they depended on a sense of where the other guy wanted to go. And then they decided they were going to get there first and beat him to it. And this is the story that I tell in my book.
Well, I'd like to look at that, on how they decide where they set up their railroad lines. I imagine the two of them are squaring off and they look at their competitor. I could use the analogy of chess. I don't know if it's the best. Maybe Settlers of Catan, if there's any board game fans out there, where you have a board, but you also have resources in different places that would make one location more desirable than another location. Risk is another analogy, if listeners are more familiar with that. So as they're thinking about where to set places up, is it because there's a valuable resource, or they think that their opponent is going to set one up, so they set up their line there, and then cities spring up in places that might otherwise have no other reason for human habitation, like, I don't know, Las Vegas, perhaps. So what's their calculus as they're thinking about where to put their lines and where to put their stops?
It's an excellent question. And there was a book from the period written by an engineer named Wellington. And it was about that very question, the economics of route choice, basically. And it ran 1,000 pages. And it was all about how it, calculations like how much does the coal cost, what is the rise in elevation that you're going to have to cross over, how much do you have to turn your tracks in order to get around some mountain, all of these things that could be calculated to the last penny. It was something that Wellington went through in 1,000 pages. Well, his basic point was, don't go anywhere unless you're going from a major population center to another major population center. Absent that, you're just going to lose your shirt. And of course, in the West, there was no major population center. So all of Wellington was pretty much useless. And so it left Palmer, who was the first one into this territory, to decide these things on his own. And what he did was, he found the few towns that were there, And he got them to compete against each other to determine who was going to decide where he was going to place his route. That there was a town, there was Pueblo, but there was also a town called Canyon City. And so that he would go to Canyon City, he was coming down from Denver, and he would approach the people, the good citizens of Canyon City, and say, I'm ready to build a train into you. How much will you pay me to bring it to your town? And they would huddle up and they would come up with a price. And then he'd say, okay, that's nice. How about you, Pueblo, this rival town, maybe 50 miles to the east, how much would you pay to receive a train from me? And they say, well, I see that Canyon City is offering $50,000. We'll give you $100,000. And so then on that basis, Amr decided to go to Pueblo. And it was on that was the decision. He just made it simple. He just found that wherever there were people, that he would try and get them to bid for his train. And if they could bid enough money to cover his costs, he would take a train there. And that's really what he did. And then once he was the first one into the territory, and so that he was set up at Pueblo. And so that meant that the Santa Fe, when it came in there in 1876, it went to Pueblo also. And so the two train lines intersected there. But then the question was, where do they go from there? And what was beckoning to them was the Great Southwest. This was, after all, the Santa Fe was the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, to give it its full name. And it had come from Kansas. And initially, it was going to be a short-run train, but one of the backers got very ambitious and decided to take it all the way to California and added the word Santa Fe into it, because that was the town that the Independence Trail from Kansas City had originally taken, and the Santa Fe Trail also. And so that was like this celebrated visionary objective of pioneers for the last 50 years at least. And so that was kind of an emblem of their greater ambitions. But the question was that Santa Fe, as you can imagine, there was one of many potential areas in the Great Southwest where a train could go. And what both men realized was that the Southwest, which those four states, Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico, were the ones that offered the most promise, because they had been, they were not, they were so far from the original transcontinental that they were basically wide open and theirs for the taking. And the question was how to get there. And so the big issue in the early part of the book is, should they go over the Raton Pass that ran at the bottom of Colorado into New Mexico? Should they risk everything and try and ascend that pass, or should they just leave it to the other guy and go someplace else? And that was they agonized and that became quite a story.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplug to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605. I wonder, with Palmer's policy of trying to base where a railroad line goes on the highest bidder, were there any places the railroad lines go that simply didn't make sense only because someone outbid another city? But if that weren't part of the equation, there's no way that the line would have gone to that city.
Well, the only reason that they would go someplace where there was nothing was to get to someplace that had something beyond it. It would be sort of a pass through. And that, you know, if you look at a railroad map from those days, that there were stations and then there were just mere depots. There were just kind of stops in the prairie that didn't have proper train stations. They didn't have big towns built up around them. They were just a place to stop every 10 miles to let people off or take people on. And so those spots were kind of what you're talking about. There were way stations, places to pass through, they were not destinations. They were not they were never a terminus. But you have to remember too about the West is that, you know, every terminus was only temporarily a terminus. It was the end of the line only for the moment. And you may have heard this term, that hell on wheels towns, were pretty much a phenomenon of that very first transcontinental, that where they would, one of the railroad lines, either the Union Pacific or the Central Pacific, would get to a certain place in the mountains, and they would stop. That was as far as they got, with that bundle of rails and the amount of ties that they could bring in. And so there would flourish a little town. But very briefly, I mean, it was amazing that suddenly a town would flare up in the wilderness out of nothing. It would be purely a temporary town. It's called an air town. And that these buildings would all be prefab. They'd be shipped in from Chicago, and that they would be erected overnight, and that they would be the flimsiest possible things, and that they'd just be a place really for the workmen to gather, and that they'd maybe and stay for weeks, and then have sort of it would be a place for saloons and drinking and gambling, and sure enough, women of the night would gather there. And so it would be a place of enormous festivity. And then the train would move on, and those air towns would disappear. That was a lot of the early days of the West, these train towns that were created from nothing for these railroad lines that were moving on to get to someplace else.
What happened to cities after railroad lines came to them, where they do exist, their destinations, maybe they're a terminus for a while? How do they change once railroad lines come?
Well, it was interesting that some of them changed and some of them didn't. I mean, the reason that the early towns of the Union Pacific never amounted to much was, as I was saying before, they didn't get the cross traffic. You need intersections. It's like with the interstate highway, that if they just run lines, rail highways, just only west and not north-south as well, you wouldn't get these at the intersection points, you wouldn't get this buildup of of traffic, and you wouldn't get the commercial activity, and you wouldn't then get the residences. You need you need more than one train line to create a town, and so so the West really didn't fill in until there were more trains to feed it. But what was so interesting to me to discover was how these train lines, these railroad towns, once they were set down, all took almost exactly the same configuration. And if you've ever been west, and most people have, you'll recognize this, where the train, usually the railroad tracks that would give birth to a road that went right alongside of them, and that was usually called Railroad Avenue. And then it would intersect another the other major road in town, usually called Main Street, that would right in the middle of town. It would mark those two streets would intersect at perfect right angles. And then the streets would radiate out from there in both directions to produce this checkerboard type arrangement of the grid. Well, the railroads brought the grid, and they brought it everywhere they went. And it meant that wherever you were in the West, you were pretty much like everywhere else in the West. And it was defined, as I say, by these intersecting roads in this absolutely methodical, straight ruler's edge way. But at the center, you would have the railroad, and with all the buildings, the warehouses and such that the railroads tended to spawn. And then you'd have the proper railroad station, and then riding up over it, there would be the clock. And to my mind, the clock was the new cross. It was a symbol of what was really the new sort of governing principle of the West that took over, I have to say, from Christianity and became a monument to the capitalism that created the West and was embodied by those railroads. And because you have to realize that once those trains created those towns, they sustained those towns as well. They brought in all passengers. They brought in all freight. They brought in fashion. They brought in the news. And they usually brought in the telegraph as well, because the telegraph office almost invariably was located in the railroad station building, and so that it was really the source of all life, and the railroads had brought that life. And you asked earlier about the impact of the railroads in America. Well, that's a good demonstration of it. They created the towns, and they also created the tone of the town. They would decide on the architectural style. They would decide on the sort of socioeconomic level of it, whether it was going to be stylish or rather plain. The more stylish it was, the bigger the house lots were, and therefore the bigger the houses that would be on those house lots. Oftentimes, the style of the railroad station was the one that was mimicked throughout the town, with all the finer buildings would be reflect that original architecture that the railroad had decided on. And that this was a time, remember, when there were not proper states in the West; there were merely territories. And so a real governing power came from these railroads and the railroad men and the railroad money behind them. The West was created by the railroads, no question.
Well, you're right about clocks. Historians of technology have used a term called the commodification of time, where with new technologies like railroads, telegraphs, steamships, postal networks, and other things where you can start planning a day down to the hour and down to a minute, having a pocket watch makes sense that it would have made no sense whatsoever in the 1750s, because why on earth would you need to lock things down to an hour? I mean, you could figure it out if you really wanted to, but this idea that we have in our minds of train conductors or ticket takers with the big chain and the pocket watch and everything makes sense for a very good reason.
Absolutely. I mean, let me just add on that, a lot of that it came from the fact that in the middle of the 19th century, around the 1850s, there was a calamitous accident on the Worcester line in Boston, where two trains that were traveling on the same tracks that coming at each other without realizing it and colliding and in a sort of catastrophic train accident. And there was an investigation of this, and they realized that the problem was that the timing was off. And what that meant was the railroads then decided a couple of things. One was that everything that they needed to worship the clock, that everything had to be run on the clock, that everybody had to know the time, everybody had to operate by the time, everything had to be calibrated in time in exactly the fashion that you're talking about. But then there was a second thing that happened that was more sweeping still, which was the railroads discovered that the longer they went west, the more they needed their own railroad time. Before that, the time was very much a local affair. It was it was determined actually by these things called time balls, and which you see every New Year's in Times Square. That ball that descends to determine the start of the new year is a vestige of these time balls that existed everywhere in America. In all of the major towns, they would all have their time balls that would determine the local time. And the local time extended only, you know, out maybe 20 miles at the most. And then it would, and then another town would have its time. And that, so that the difference between New York and Boston, for example, was like 11 minutes that people added, there was a discrepancy of time. Well, as the trains went west, that was became a bigger and bigger issue. And so they got together and decided, the trains did, and decided that they would determine their, they would establish their own time, irrespective of the local time, and that they weren't even going to turn to the government to help with this, they were going to do it. And so they came up with this system of that we have today of the four time zones that completely reorganized American sense of time.
There you go, listeners, the American time zones and daylight savings day brought to you by railroads. Well, I guess it's farmers that brought us daylight savings time, but well, that shows the power of them. And you mentioned earlier that the two men behind the Rio Grande and the Santa Fe lines, they're not just leaders of corporations. When they're fighting each other, don't think of cola wars in the 1980s or platform wars of Nintendo versus Sega, where corporations have ad campaigns against each other. Maybe they're trying to tie up contracts with other people. Maybe they're trying to crowd into emerging markets and have some lawyers to solve any discrepancies. Oh no, friends, this is the 19th century where things get way more violent, where they're essentially, I don't know, it's like a mafia war where you have paramilitary groups fighting each other. So can you tell me about what happens, which gets in the meat of your book, of when Strong and Palmer, how do they clash with each other, and what does that clash look like?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. Basically, you know, one of the sub-themes of the book is about capitalism. And capitalism is, you know, is the manipulation of what Adam Smith called, you know, private interest. But it could better be called greed. And that the capitalist impulse lay behind every conflict that these two men had. And what it was that neither man could bear the thought of sharing anything valuable. They wanted an exclusive. They wanted it for themselves alone. They wanted to keep it so that the other guy couldn't have it. And that just, you know, they could have avoided endless trouble, and they could have said each one could have lived a merry life and had enormous success if they'd been willing to share, but that wasn't their approach. And there were things about these men that probably encouraged competition. And one of them was that they were very different. That this General Palmer was a Civil War hero. He had actually been a spy after Antietam and was caught behind enemy lines. He had offered to go behind enemy lines to follow Lee's troop movements and then send word back to McClellan to let him know what the South was up to. And he got caught, and that he ended up in a hellhole prison for 3 months before he was able to win his freedom. He was traded for another man caught in similar circumstance in the North. And he comes back to the war and then ends up doing the work of finding Jefferson Davis when he tried to flee after Antietam, that it was General Palmer who tracked him down in Georgia. Anyway, so he was a very, a heroic character in his own mind and in others, and that he was somewhat imperious. He was a Quaker. He had some ambivalence about the use of violence, but he was a very egotistical guy, and he wanted to win. Strong, by contrast, was a corporate manager, very by the book, cards close to his chest sort of character, who was not really known for his personality, only for his determination. And I think that Palmer basically wanted to show this guy. He ran his own company as a very much a sole proprietorship. It was a mom and pop operation in his own mind. He called it his little family. And Strong, by contrast, viewed his very much as a sprawling corporation, and that he wanted to make it as big as possible, whereas Palmer prided himself in keeping his own line small. So they had a different approach to things. But they came to blows because each of them set their sights first on the Raton Pass, but more significantly on the richest silver mine in the West. And that was in the town called Leadville. It doesn't sound like much, but it was actually not just the richest silver mine in the West, but the richest in the entire world. It put out more silver at its height than in any country except Mexico. And so that was something that was immensely desirable to a railroad, because the way silver works is that you dig it out of, or you extract it from, this very heavy substance called ore carbonate. And it's extremely bulky, and that railroads are perfectly suited to hauling it out. And that was made a lot of money for the railroads, and it would do particularly well for the railroads since the silver was so abundant. Well, the way to Leadville ran up through a narrow canyon called the Royal Gorge. And it was a V-shaped canyon, very steep on either side, 1,000 feet up from the Arkansas River that cut through it to the top of the cliffs on either side. And it was so narrow at the base that there was room for only one set of tracks. Well, whose tracks would they be? And in the West in those days, that for the most part, the spoils went to the man who got there first. Possession was not just 9/10 of the law; it really was the whole thing. So that if you got there first, it was yours. And as it happened, that the Santa Fe was the one to get there first. But Palmer was such a determined character that he would not accept this, even though it was a more sensible course of action just to let them have it and then try and go someplace else. But no, he wanted, if they had it, he wanted it all the more. And so he started laying down track beside the track of the Santa Fe. As I said before, it was narrow enough only for one set of tracks, but only through a certain passages in this 20-mile route up to through the gorge to Leadville. And so they could start out side by side, but further on they would have to narrow down to a place where one set of tracks could go through. And the difficulty, of course, was that they both wanted something that only one of them could have. And so they each of them, starting with Palmer, they brought in not just the workmen, but they turned the workmen into soldiers. They armed them. And he put his men up on the top of the gorge on one side and set up forts up there to protect them at the 800, 900 feet up, and then rolled boulders down from there onto the tracks of the Santa Fe to destroy them. Well, of course, the Santa Fe responded by doing exactly the same thing. They put forts of their own on the other side of the track and then rolled boulders down from there to destroy destroy the Rio Grande. Well, that went on for a while. And then that became, of course, a legal issue that went to the Supreme Court. And then it became a matter for public opinion. There was a war over that, where every newspaper in Colorado took one side or the other. And on it went. It was so expensive for Palmer that he ended up having to allow the Santa Fe to lease his railroad, all 337 miles of track, all the buildings, everything. He could no longer support it. But then, even though he signed the lease, giving that to Santa Fe for 30 years, he immediately tried to get it back, and then ended up taking it back by force and creating soldiers not just along the tracks by the Royal Gorge, but everywhere in Colorado where his tracks ran. And some of these were mercenaries, desperados. The Santa Fe responded by collecting the soldiers from one of the towns that they went to in Kansas, a little place called Dodge City, where Bat Masterson was in charge. And Bat came with some of his men and pistol happy cowboys to intimidate the Rio Grande troops. The Rio Grande responded by bringing out the Colorado militia. There were several hundred, maybe even 1,000 soldiers on either side, marauding all about the state. And then finally, it ended up being what might be called a Mexican standoff. They were just simply not able to resolve this between them. They took the line back, but they put it in receivership. It goes on and on. But the only way ultimately that this matter could be decided was when a power even greater than anything they possessed or that the Supreme Court possessed could step in and simply settle things on his own. And that man was Jay Gould, the greatest of the robber barons who had interests in the state and in Colorado, and in fact, all of the West. And he had the power to resolve the matter at a stroke, and he did.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
It's interesting that Palmer, who was a general, lost this conflict when we're talking about what's essentially a military action, where you have military construction, demolition works, which is also something involved in war. You have battle plans, war strategy. Why did Gould favor Strong instead of Palmer?
I don't think he favored one over the other. He favored Jay Gould. That what he wanted, he had an interest in the Union Pacific and in the Kansas Pacific, which at that point was the other line making its way west. And those were the lines that went further north from the Santa Fe and from the Rio Grande. And so what he primarily wanted was to make sure that Strong, whom he regarded as the more ambitious and probably more capable of the railroad men, he wanted to make sure that Strong was kept well away from his two properties. So I think the overriding interest of Palmer was to make sure that Strong went south and not north from Pueblo, because the ruling that he imposed on these two men was the Rio Grande was to stay north of Pueblo, this town at the center of the state, and the Strong and the Santa Fe stay south, and that they not interfere with each other for 10 years. That was the kind of the gist of it. And that the Rio Grande would be given the right to go to Leadville, and that they would have to pay the Santa Fe for the track that they built. You would think that, I mean, there are any number of ways to look at it, because the rights to Leadville were the thing that they were fighting over, so that if Palmer got those, he'd come out ahead. Well, yes, he had, but only in the short term. And one of the things about Strong being a corporate leader, he was able to think long term, and that he realized that he now had free rein to run as far to the southwest as he wanted to, because he would never be interfered with by Palmer again. So he lost the right to Leadville, but he won the right to go to the southwest. And ultimately, that led him to develop this little town called Los Angeles into the second largest city in the United States. So that was pretty good. And Leadville, sadly, the silver was soon exhausted, and that town plunged into bankruptcy. And that Gould, however, was left free to develop the Union Pacific and the Kansas Pacific, so that his fortunes were certainly undiminished and saved, really, by this Treaty of Boston, as he called it, that he came up with to end the railroad war.
Well, as listeners who recognize railroad lines in America know, the Santa Fe goes on to incredible success, and the Rio Grande enters a death spiral. What did it look like for the Rio Grande to enter a death spiral? What caused it? And was it only Los Angeles that caused the incredible rise of the Santa Fe, or were there other factors too?
Well, there's as far as the failure of the Rio Grande, I think that its doom was sealed at the very beginning, because he had this idea that he wanted to keep it was known as the Baby Road, his railroad, Baby Road, that it was a line that he regarded as his little family. He's, as I mentioned before, he was a Quaker, and he believed in sort of Quakerist virtues of peace, harmony, and fellow feeling, things like that, that were not at all part of the crash and bang of corporate warfare. And so he really wasn't suited to being a sort of fierce competition that he ended up being involved with. And so I think that, and that on top of that, that one of the fundamental differences between the Rio Grande and the Santa Fe, among all the others, was the fact that the Rio Grande adhered to what was called the narrow gauge. The narrow gauge was the width of the tracks that the trains ran on. And narrow gauge was 3 feet wide. Narrow gauge was extremely unusual as time, it became used less and less as time went along. And the Santa Fe, by contrast, used what was called standard gauge. It was a gauge that amazingly was established by President Lincoln himself when they were working out the gauge that the Union Pacific would use to create the first transcontinental. That was substantially wider. That was 4 feet, 6 1/2 inches. And that meant that with the wider gauge, you could run more cars. It was meant for volume business, that you would have big, wide cars banging along those tracks and going and with enormous power. The narrow gauge was suited best for these tight mountain passes, a lot of twists and turns, but not for great distances. So that ultimately the Rio Grande was limited by its own initial aspirations, and that it But transcontinentals were volume businesses. If you didn't have a lot of track, you didn't have a lot of track to support the operation, and that he was constantly running short of funds, and that he was always going back to New York to beg for financing. Strong didn't have that problem. He was backed by what was called the Boston crowd. It was the Santa Fe, curiously enough, was based in Boston. Boston initially was a great railroad hub. That and New York and Philadelphia were funded most of the Western expansion. And the Santa Fe had a pretty steady supply of money, and that as it's as it grew from a line of just a few hundred miles to a line of several thousand miles, that it was in a far better position in terms of capitalization for expansion, and also for it to tide it over in the rough spots when there was an economic reverse, that they could weather those economic storms far better than the Rio Grande ever could. So the Santa Fe was simply in a better economic position. And interestingly, the resolution of the war between the Rio Grande and the Santa Fe, it didn't occur in the United States at all. It happened in Mexico. And that Strong had turned to Mexico, stealing Palmer's original idea of going to the Bay of California and then hitting the Pacific there to send steamers around to California and then further west to Australia and the Far East. I mean, out to the Far East. So he did that to going to a place called Guaymas in Mexico, sort of due south from Tucson. And that when Palmer saw that he had done that he then was determined to try and outdo him by putting in tracks of his own in all of Mexico, running a line down from the Rio Grande to down from Texas through to the Mexico City, and then going across the Mexico from Veracruz in the east to I think it was Manzillo on the west, so he's going to crisscross the entire country. And at that point, you have to remember that Mexico was very leery of American trains, that it was very late to get one. And the reason that it didn't have any was that they were so burned by the experience of fighting the Americans in the Mexican-American War that was finally finished in 1848, that they didn't want to have anything to do with American capitalists for fear that they would install a train that would run deep into the heart of the country and then send troops aboard it so that they could then take over the country in a matter of hours. And they were terrified of this, not unreasonably, but they also deeply envied American prosperity. And they felt that they were a bygone nation watching their far more prosperous neighbor to the north suddenly become a global empire. And they wanted to have some part of that. And Porfirio Diaz, the president, soon to be the dictator in Mexico, came to see that that was the wiser course. And so he invited American railroads, starting with Strong, and that first line down to the Pacific border. And then the question was he going to let in Palmer to put in his train? Well, when Strong learned that Palmer had this idea of putting in a crisscross train through the entire country of Mexico, he decided that he was going to do that. And since he'd already put in what was called the Sonoma Railroad down to the Mexican coast, that Porfirio Diaz gave him the better routes that ran into the country and gave worse ones to Palmer. Well, Strong was able to create his railroad fairly quickly. Palmer struggled with his and lost tons of money doing it, and his was never completed. Strong's was. And so Palmer then was in a terrible position to advance his own railroad interests back in Colorado, since he'd lost so much money in Mexico. And so that he had to really trim his sails and limit himself to just making one last sort of desperate move to send a line through the mountains into Utah, where he could link with the Union Pacific there at in the Mormon capital of Salt Lake City. And when that, but it was too little, too late, that there would have been a, to do that, he had to basically mortgage the company that the board members of his original company revolted. They ended up throwing him out of his very own Rio Grande Railroad, and that ended his railroading career in 1887. And that where Strong went flying on to Los Angeles, San Diego, and was able to break this enormous monopoly that had controlled California. And as I said before, was able to make this little backwater of Los Angeles into the preeminent city, not only of California, but the second largest city, as you know, in all of the United States. So that was an extraordinary accomplishment on his part. And the consequences for the nation are still being felt.
What do you think are parallels today in the 21st century of this railroad war? Thinking of examples, you had mentioned earlier tech companies, and something that came into my mind was that Facebook and Google are essentially a duopoly when it comes to advertising. Any sort of online advertising is almost completely controlled by them. You can do one or the other or both, as many online marketers do, but it's almost impossible to ignore them. And to break this up would probably cause antitrust legislation, and they're already starting to circle around and snipe at each other. Are there any other types of things today in the 21st century that you see as comparable to the 19th century battle? And do you think this can give us any insight into how the future can go?
Well, it's an excellent question. I mean, it, clearly, to my mind, that those two and all the transcontinentals were the platform firms of their day. And the, you know, Amazon, Google, the fangs, as they're called, are clearly the modern day, the preeminent modern day equivalent. They have a stranglehold over the economy, of the stock market. They have powers over the government that are unequaled by any other firm, any other industry. There's really nothing like them, as there was nothing like the railroads back in the 19th century. And it's interesting to see what happened to them, that you know, no empire lasts forever, no matter how strong it appears to be. That one of the things that happens is that size is a, proves to be, at a certain point, a liability. And you can sort of see this almost in geometric terms, that as something, as a circle gets bigger and bigger, the boundary around it, its perimeter that has to be defended, becomes greater and greater and greater. So the points of contact, the points of vulnerability expand. And that you simply, it's just becomes too easy, too difficult to run something that is so big. It has too many consequences. You create too many enemies. There are too many liabilities. There's too much complexity. There's just too much of being too much. And that's what happened to the transcontinentals. They in order to maintain themselves, they then first ran into trouble as they extended across the United States, and they filled in all the blanks, that there was no more open space. They then started crossing into each other's markets, and they faced this perennial question whether to cooperate or to compete. Well, to compete meant having these railroad price wars that would diminish either the company's ability to sustain itself. Or to cooperate meant that they were setting rates and were were operating, you know, too explicitly like governments of their own and ran afoul of regulators, because if they set the rate too high, the farmers in the Midwest wouldn't be able to, they couldn't transport their produce. But if they set it too low, the railroads themselves might run out of business. And it was difficult to establish this, to set this just right, that was going to appeal to everybody, and that everybody was affected. So that inevitably you had a variety of interest groups who had a variety of reactions, that some of them, wanted the rates to be high, others wanted them to be low. And so ultimately the government had to step in to set the rates for the railroad, because so many of the railroads were going out of business, and they were an essential element of the economy. But then they set the regulations so tight that when the First World War came along, the railroads were unable to provide for the national services in the national emergency. And then, of course, but within that, there was a fascinating issue that emerged that I think is very pertinent today. And that is people somehow assumed that there was such a thing as the public interest, that the railroads needed to be regulated in the public interest. Well, what is the public interest? And what you realize when you think about this is that there's really no such thing. There's only private interest, special interest. The farmers had a different idea than the lumbermen. The manufacturers had a different idea than the passengers. Certain classes of passengers had different views than other classes of passengers. People who favored long-haul routes had different ideas than people who favored short-haul routes. It was just, there was such a variety of interests that there was no single public interest that could be served. Well, I think that what's going to happen as people look at the issues surrounding Google, Facebook, Amazon, and the rest, is that they're going to run up against a similar conundrum. Whose interest is to be represented here? Take the issue the dissemination of public information. To some, more information is better, and that they're capable of discerning what's reliable information and what isn't. To others, of course, that kind of dissemination of information leads to this terrible civil strife that we've seen erupt at the Capitol and other places. How to handle that? How to act in the public interest? I think this is going to prove to be a desperately difficult thing to resolve. And these companies have gotten to be so big that they serve so many different interests, and that none of them are going to find themselves in agreement with many others. And that you're going to see an atomization, really, of reactions, that everybody is going to have an individual reaction, and that there is no clear collective reaction that the people are going to be able to point to and say, yeah, that's a good idea. And so I think that's something that I feel is pertinent here, that it seems like these companies need to be turned into public utilities, but it's not like water or gas, that they're providing, and that the railroads it was very difficult to organize the railroads. And then, of course, the railroads gave way to automobiles and highways that were built by the federal government. And so the railroad issue simply disappeared, kind of buried under its own weight.
All right. Well, things definitely change, and companies that seem invincible at one point can, like you said, be drastically altered or disappear. So nothing is permanent. Well, this is an important story, and like you said, there are parallels to today. And for listeners who want to check out more, the name of the book is From the River to the Sea, The Untold Story of the Railroad War That Made the West. John, thank you for joining us.
Hey, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on, Scott.
Absolutely.
All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.